I'd like to start by saying that it's a great privilege to be afternoon and evening with you.
This is Crichton Wheeler talking earlier this year at the International Mothers Union Convention in Tashkent.
Like this, Willie, or even goodbye to half our audience.
For Crichton, the well-known sufferer of Spicer's disease, any speaking engagement is a major challenge.
Is to be foreskinned and other minorities joining us today.
Especially for the listener.
What twank the lot of you.
Spicer's disease then affects the sufferer by suddenly removing words and phrases while he or she is speaking. It is a mystery ailment for which there is no adequate medical explanation. Good evening. My name's Brian Hayes, and over the next 4 weeks, I'll be examining the career of Crichton Wheeler and the dreadful burden he must bear every time he opens his mouth. Mommy. Crichton was born Crichton Myrtle Roger DeCampari Wheeler sometime between 3 and 5 on the morning of the 22nd of March, 1935. His mother, Evagine, was a simple housewife who made extra money impersonating Prince Gustav of Romania, a bogus royal, whom I'll come to later. His father, Crichton Sr., was a promising silent movie star. It's impossible to get a clear impression from this audio clip as to what kind of actor he really was. Sadly, Crichton Sr.'s rising star was to be extinguished by the arrival of talking pictures.
Daphne, I know it's difficult for you with me constantly gay. Wouldn't you like to see what I've brought you from the Horn of Fame?
This extract from the 1931 comedy of manners, The Hooded Merchant, directed by Crispin Nobjoy, did not go down well with a public eager to enjoy the talky picture craze.
I must have forgotten the third.
In fact, critics remarked that his voice resembled that of a puff.
Daphne.
Worse, he was showing the symptoms of the illness that would eventually scar the life of his son, Crichton.
Daphne.
For years, Spicer's disease has baffled specialists. Dr. Kerry Schnurkiewicz, consultant surgeon at the Laboratoire Garnier in Paris, studied the phenomenon for many years, until his sudden death, minutes after he explained his interpretation of it to a Look East reporter.
One school of thought has emerged that suggests that the mind is moving faster than the voice, and that the speaker is literally jumping to the next idea, unaware that it is out of sequence. Excuse me, what are you doing in here?
This was later dismissed by other doctors as bullshit, but the explanation has credibility with those who read scripts aloud every day. Journalist and newsreader Michael Burke.
When you're reading an autocue, your eyes are frequently several words or even a sentence ahead of what you're saying. Very occasionally you can be... I think I'm missing a page here.
Thanks, Mikey. But let's return to the story. Crichton Sr. reluctantly swapped the Hollywood stage for Walthamstow Dog Track, where he worked as a bitch heater. Until one night, during the 8:33, his bootlace caught in the electric hair. Bookies placed him first, ahead of Dapper Dandy and Happy Boy, before anyone noticed he was dead. Evagine took complete control of Crichton's upbringing. Her son was tutored privately in the classics, taught basic algebra, and how to bring himself off in polite company. Evagine's main source of employment, however, was about to run dry. She had made a very handsome living impersonating Prince Gustav of Romania. The prince had been a regular guest at palace garden parties and a dignitary at many distinguished events, until Burke's peerage noticed he didn't exist. Because he didn't exist, the establishment were too stupid to think anyone would be stupid enough to think of impersonating him. Too embarrassed to admit their mistake, they continued to allow Prince Gustav's double to exist while secretly hunting down the real one, who didn't exist. On the run from the Royal Secret Police, Crichton's mother fled to Dublin. From this time on, Crichton was completely in the hands of his beloved nanny, Daphne Kennedy. Crichton, showing the early signs of Spicer's disease, truncated her name to Daddy, which was clearly going to lead to complications. Daphne Kennedy adored her charge, but this idyllic childhood was interrupted by the news that England was now at war with Germany.
You know, I don't feel very well today. I think I did not. And I'll tell you something else.
Did
Like many boys of his age, Crichton was evacuated. After a mix-up at wartime administration, however, he was sent from Belgravia to Clapham Junction, where he stayed with a stuffy widow. When she was blown to chunks by the Luftwaffe, he was moved from house to house during the All Clears until he was finally put up with publicans Ronnie and Violet Crowther, who owned the Rose and Crown in Vicarage Way, Battersea. They fondly remember Crichton. For money.
Oh, he was a sweet young man. Always happy to help out in the pub.
Do you remember we made him stand outside and direct the warden, the non-existent UXBs, whilst we carried on with our cockfighting?
Oh, yeah, he was a nice boy.
Oh, yeah. During the war, you see, there were a lot of cockfights, especially between Polish and Armenian refugees and their cocks.
But this has nothing to do with Crichton.
Well, no, that's true, but we made a lot of money out of cockfighting, enough to finance much of the post-war rebuilding effort that was to ultimately lead to the...
Was Crichton displaying any signs of his condition?
Well, he was always stuttering, but we thought that was because he was drunk. We never had any food in the pub, you see, just...
Regency pale and grain for the cocks. It was lovely beer, mine, and he was a lovely boy.
Lovely beer and grain for the cocks.
Thank you, Violet.
No, it's Ronnie.
Right.
According to Crichton, though, that's not what really happened.
Well, Ronnie and Violet were like so many, quacking up behind the horse box, selling cheap Crystal Palace. Certainly, Violet taught me how to place my plums very hard on my dictacs, grammar, and corrected my many dangling thongs.
Reunited on D-Day with his nanny Daddy, Crichton learned that his mother had been kidnapped by British intelligence and deployed by the Allies as a music hall comedienne to fool Hitler into thinking Arthur Askey was funny.
Hello, playmates.
Hi there, girl. Hi there, girl. This is the very funny joke what I've just made up.
It failed, and she was gassed on stage at the Alhambra Theatre in Mexico City.
Excuse me laughing, I know what's coming with it. Hi there, girl. Hi there, girl. I am dying.
Crichton was devastated. But then came some unexpected news. Evergene's son showed terrific academic potential, and his tutor suggested to Nanny Daddy he apply for a scholarship to Hornchurst College, a public school that wasn't as good as Eton.
And did those feet in ancient time.
His written exams were outstanding, but his interview was a bizarre affair, as the admissions master, Sir Ralph Porch Tungsten, remembers.
I recall he had a very peculiar shaped head at that time, and after 10 minutes of being seated, he brought out a head prop. As he was saying what he thought of Gerard Manley Hopkins, he fired a grolly at my secretary. It landed plumb on her ugly face. For that reason alone, he seemed an ideal student.
Worse was to follow when the master asked him about why he would want to come to Hornchurst.
He spat out several phrases, like that, none of which really made any sense on their own, and yet together they were strangely intelligible. At the time, we thought he simply had a speech defect, which would, with careful remedial treatment, gradually get worse.
This treatment included a speech therapist twice a week and the use of a phonetic enforcer. He was attached to the machine and would endure an electric shock every time he spoke incorrect English or pronounced a word wrongly. Amazingly, the machine was the subject of a Pathé newsreel featuring Crichton and other backward boys celebrating a new frontier in remedial care. But Crichton has a different spin on it.
Well, that silly machine only succeeded in making my condition a treat. If anything, it helped me exacerbate the problem and added to a troubled adolescent body, Rochester bypass. Luckily, I was taken in by a millionaire business dog.
This is the phonetic enforcer, used in special schools around the country. Let's see how it works.
Mary had a little crease was whiter. Now!
This boy has splicer's disease. In fact, he's a cripple.
Mary had a little crease was whiter snow. There! And everywhere that went, there! The lamb would show. There!
But he has no trouble getting used to the phonetic enforcer.
The lamb would show. There! Now! Now!
By the time Crichton reached his second year at Hornchurst, the effects of Splicer's disease were becoming chronic. His housemaster, Mr. George Hyman, being rather enamoured of his charge, proposed a radical alternative, a public badgering, which in those days was known as shitting. He believed that exposure to humiliation whilst being shitted would have a cathartic effect on the boy, freeing him from his demons. The date of the ting was set in the school diary, and for that year was to take the place of the annual hen squeeze. Crichton's great day never arrived, as a week before the ceremony, his housemaster collapsed after meeting Dirk Bogard. Then Elizabeth II was coronated. Out of the blue, and for no apparent reason, Crichton was chosen from thousands of schoolboys to offer a short speech at the coronation. The event was one of the first to be televised by the BBC and narrated by Sir Richard Dimbleby.
And I have another memory that I shall cherish of a little boy, Crichton, in white shirt and shorts. How small and young he seemed uttering the coronation service, though none, in fact, was needed.
I speak for the long boys of Hornchester. We salute you, Queen Elizabeth. For all of us, our loyalty remains forever to the creep love for you, as now you have become our queer today.
Get off.
Long may she be printed.
Get off.
At school, his academic work continued to be outstanding. He also showed a great gift for the organ. By the sixth form, Crichton was growing in confidence. He was editor of the bulging school magazine, The Hornchurst Hurrah, which under his stewardship was known as the Ha! And fitted neatly onto half a side of A4. Then Crichton learnt that his prodigious musical talents had won him a scholarship to King's College, Cambridge. He was overjoyed and was bursting to start at King's. But first he spent 3 years touring around Europe. He became intimate with many of the leading French intellectuals of the 50s and struck up a close friendship with Jacques Cousteau, a touching association that only worked properly when they were underwater together.
Jacques, why do we keep coming down here?
We learn something new.
Jacques, I seem to run low on oxygen.
It is the pumice that lures us.
Could I have some of your air? Could you give me air? Jacques!
Crichton had learned to play military side drums as well as the organ at Hornchurst and was inevitably drawn towards the latest form of expressionism in music, jazz. He travelled to New York and met Charlie Parker and John Coltrane. One night at the Blue Note, he sat in with them. Art Blowhole Schatz, a tenor-playing contemporary of Coltrane's, recalls Crichton's drumsmanship.
He was a cool cat. He had a beautiful light bebop style. The train and the others thought was just too far out. He played the drums and he played with his mouth. just like that. But he had his own time plan, which we all knew could really expand the improvisation process as long as everyone in the group knew exactly what beat Crichton was digging.
Put differently, Crichton's drumming was bollocks. This recording of Crichton playing with John Coltrane reveals the extent of his piss-poor musical skills. Stung by the criticism, Crichton would eventually resurface in the emerging jazz scene in London, where you could be crap and no one would notice. Next week, we look at Crichton's first steps into the theatre, the failure of his show at the Edinburgh Fringe of 1961, and his brush with the satirists' movement. We'll hear from Alan Wicker.
Hello there.
Brian Sewell.
Hello.
And Rick Wakeman.
Hey, how you doing?
Until next week. Goodbye. Wheeler's Fortunes was written and performed by Andrew McGibbon. It featured Michael Burke, Toby Longworth, Cameron Stewart and Ian Ballamy. Additional material was written by David Quantick, the script editor was Nick Romero, and the programme was produced by Andrew McGibbon and Jonathan Ruffle. Wheeler's Fortunes is a Curtains for Radio testbed production for Radio 4.